Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Hello. Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. I'm Brett Winton, ARK Invest's chief futurist and host of FYI. We have a great show for you today. Today we have Nick Grout. How do I pronounce your last name, Nick?
Gruce. It is Gruce, yes.
I've never, you know, how many years have we worked together and I don't even know?
Six.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Nick Gruce, I just learned this. He covers digital consumer for us as an associate portfolio manager. And we're going to talk to Kino. First, I'd like to start out and ask you, Nick, how do we think about the future of the consumer, connected TV, the shift to advertising models in front of streamers? Where are we and where are we going?
It's a lot to unpack, but I'll do my best. I think when we look at the digital consumer, it's very much focused on digital, right? We are moving more of our entertainment, our attention onto screens. It's everywhere. COVID only accelerated this trend, but everything we do now is attached to a screen in some format when it comes to entertainment. And when it comes to streaming specifically, again, COVID, a huge burst, huge pull forward of demand for streaming, but streaming isn't going anywhere. It's completely changed the model of distribution, and it's what consumers want. Consumers are asking for streaming. Linear TV is in a secular decline. Cord-cutting rates continue to tick up. Viewership in linear is coming down. And streaming is taking share. I was just mentioning this to you off camera, but if you look at the Nielsen data when it comes to streaming versus cable and broadcast, which you can bucket together to give you that linear, streaming has grown from 29% in 2021, May of 2021, to now 41% as of this last month in July. So it's taking share from cable and broadcast because it delights the consumer. That's, you know, as simply as I can put it, it is more of a delightful experience than linear, where it is pre-programmed content that's distributed to every single house. When it comes to streaming, it's on demand, you choose, it's a la carte. And so when we first talked to Kino, because I do want to introduce the company here, we found that the model that they were pioneering was really interesting and needed in the market. Brett, you talk about this when we get into the actual podcast, but Netflix is heralded as this data-driven company. And it turns out, you know, during our research and talking with Kino, it's not actually that true. You know, the way that they decide on movies is not as data-driven as one might expect. And Kino really promises to be a data-driven solution to help surface content from indie producers to distribute to the end consumers through applications on smart TVs and on the mobile phone. So I think, you know, we're seeing a lot of innovation in the space broadly, and it's really to reach the consumer where they are, which is mobile. It's, you know, you have to be on every single device that the consumer is, and that's, you know, a litany of them today. You have smart TVs, iPads, laptops, desktops, mobile. You know, you're shifting your attention across these different devices all day. So if you don't have an application on each one of these, you're missing out on time spent.
So like one of the major shifts that's happening right now, or you mentioned like 40% of viewership is now on streamers, but 40% of the TV ad market hasn't shifted over.
No.
And so like one, why not? And then why would that begin happening now?
Yeah. I mean, we have been pounding this table. We just talked. We've been working together for 6 years. I think it was one of my first research projects at ARK. You know, where is the attention in television and where are the ad dollars? And it was as soon as I started in 2018, 2019, you already saw the trend towards streaming. You know, this is back then in 2018, 2019, that was the beginning of the streaming wars, right? So everyone was focused on when is HBO, when is Disney, when are they going to enter the market? Netflix is running away with it, and the viewers are there. And it's still true. The viewers are where streaming is, and linear rates are coming down. But advertising dollars are extremely sticky, and it's extremely frustrating to see the amount of dollars still spent in the linear TV space, which is around $60 billion in the US, and you compare that to $25 billion in connected TV, which, you know, when you think about the numbers and you're talking about, you know, over 50% penetration of CTV households versus declining rates in linear, you're asking yourself, why is there still so many advertising dollars locked in to the linear market as it's in a decline? And the answer, I mean, quite simply, is sports rights. It's unfortunate, but, you know, there are a lot of advertising dollars tied to sports. Sports are still very much linear distribution. We're starting to see today, and we've talked about this over the years, we're starting to see sports rights shift into streaming, but it takes time. And I think one thing that's really interesting here is you have companies that have one foot in the streaming world and one foot in the linear world. Take a company like Disney, which has massive distribution in linear. It's a very profitable business for them. It has always been a profitable business for them. And they can't just cannibalize their own business in linear and move it to streaming overnight. It takes time. It purposely takes time so that they don't come out, you know, next quarter and report a very bad number. And it's that those types of kind of holds in the market that are causing this discrepancy in terms of ad dollars and viewers. But it's historically, it's what has happened. We've talked about this in the past. If you go back to 08, 09, and you look at what happened to print, it was almost the same thing that's currently playing out in the CTV space today. Print, in terms of viewership and readership, massively declined. But the ad dollars stayed there for almost all of the recession. It was only until we exited that great financial recession that advertising dollars actually started to move into both television and then more so into digital. So, you know, there's a lot of different components as to why advertising dollars are still locked. But in our view, it's absolutely wrong. I mean, you are missing out on massive opportunities, not just because this is where viewership is, but also because CTV offers you so many more different efficiencies and performance metrics that you can't have in linear. If I'm advertising in linear, I'm reaching every single household I want with the same advertisement. When you're working with digital rails and streaming companies, you and I are seeing different advertisements based on what we are interested in. So it's high performative advertising versus linear. We're watching the same advertisements, whether or not we have anything in common or not. So yeah, it's, you know, really interesting.
I mean, one thing that, like, it's interesting you bring up that example of essentially an incumbent, you know, throwing sand in the gears or resisting the transition to some degree because they have such a profitable linear business. And then, like, Netflix, on the other hand, monetizes, I think, globally at a rate of around 15 cents an hour, mm-hmm. something like that. And if you look at, if they're able to monetize attention at the same rate that linear is on an advertising basis, you know, they could materially increase their monetization rates per hour of viewership. And so, you know, they're actually incentivized to move in that direction, whereas kind of the traditional linear players are incentivized to slow things down. So do you think that actually Netflix, even though it has less experience in advertising land than the more traditional players, might actually get to a better monetization rate on its advertised products relative to the incumbents?
Yeah, I think when we look at this space, what advertising or what you're able to do in advertising in the CTV realm is very akin to what you're able to do in the social media world. And look at the numbers there, right? Digital marketing and social, you're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars. The linear market never, you know, even eclipsed $100 billion in even its peak in terms of advertising dollars. It's only when you add in the subscription fee that you get a market that's over $100 billion. So I think what we're going to see with CTV, because of the performance that you can get, because of the personalization you can layer on to the market, you're going to see CTV actually outgrow linear. So if, you know, linear was doing 80 billion at its peak, we think CTV is going to actually eclipse that. I think our forecast currently right now is for 2030, CTV to grow to 73 billion, up from the 25 billion I quoted for 2023 earlier.
Okay. And then talk about what does that mean for the kind of like connected TV platform players, Amazon Fires, the Rokus, the Google, didn't they discontinue Chromecast and now they're calling it something else?
Yeah.
But, you know, whatever Google is doing, like, how do you think about kind of the, what that means for those players and how they're in competition with each other and does it benefit them?
Yeah, it's a great question and one we get all the time. And I think there's a lot of misconceptions in the market because when you say the word streaming, everyone's immediately triggered to think Netflix, Disney Plus, HBO Max. And that's absolutely true. Those are the distribution channels. They're SVOD services in the market, AVOD services in the market, and they're all competing for eyeballs. What we're talking about when we talk about Roku and Amazon Fire, those are the platforms or the operating systems that power the television you're actually watching those streaming services on. And the way that they monetize is by taking a cut of either the advertising units, so the ad load, or they take a cut of the subscription fee if, as a user, you sign up for Netflix through your Roku account. So we look at those as operating systems in the same way that we look at Apple and iOS and its App Store as an operating system and a platform to support that industry. So when we look at a Roku, which has greater than 50% penetration of broadband households, that means that there is a Roku television or streaming stick in over 50% of U.S. households in this past quarter. That type of reach in cable broadcast, unfathomable, right? You had to literally go around the country and lay cable to reach your end customer. Now it's all over the top. So it's if you have broadband, you have access to these streaming services. So we're talking about, you know, global distribution, right? That's what Netflix, you know, that's the ultimate story for Netflix. It's not just a US story, it's a global story, right? You had Squid Games, you have all these different markets that they're operating in, being able to bring out native content from all of these different countries. Roku, Amazon, they don't have to stop in just the US. Roku's the number eight operating system in Mexico. They work in Europe. It's big in Latin America. It's huge in Canada. So these are global stories. These are global platforms. And that means that the reach that they have, again, it's nothing that you could even compare to in the times of cable and broadcast, because it was just a different way of distributing content. Now it's global. And so these stories are massive. And we really think that they're extremely underappreciated and misunderstood, because again, it sits beneath all of the fighting that's going on between these different streaming companies. Roku doesn't compete against Netflix. It doesn't compete against Disney Plus. It supports those companies. It helps surface the content, right? If you have a Roku television, your home screen, that home screen is reaching 120 million viewers every single day. That's Super Bowl-like numbers, right? And so if you're a streamer and you have a new show or movie that you wanna showcase, you go to Roku and you advertise with Roku, because they can put that front and center to 100 million viewers every single day. So these are extremely powerful platforms. And again, they're global opportunities, not just US, it's global.
Yeah, I mean, the way I think about it is it's like two things. One, as you highlighted, as competitive intensity like raises, if Netflix wants to like retain customers, they need to have people continuing to watch their shows. And if you're watching traditional TV, you notice that like the ad blocks are filled not just with advertisements for products, but also advertisements for other shows that the network is trying to like make sure that you continue to watch. And so Roku serves as a platform for those kinds of ads. And as the monetization model shifts from a, hey, we're charging subscriptions and trying to retain subscribers, into a, also we're doing advertising monetization across these streaming platforms, then actually the breadth of the TVOS becomes more important,
right?
Because they can provide data on the underlying users, so you can have better targeted ads, and kind of agglomerating big audiences is the entire game in attracting ad dollars and getting high CPMs. And so kind of it seems like they have at least a couple of tailwinds in their favor. All right, now I want to transition to, with that as the context, what attracted you to Kino, and what do you look forward to users or listeners finding out about in our conversation with them here?
Yeah, one, you know, the founders, Austin and Daryl, they're, you know, truly amazing. I think each one has a very unique story which brought them into the film industry, and what they're trying to disrupt is really the traditional studio model. And that's, I think, what originally attracted us to Kino, because we've been very focused on democratization across all of the digital consumer, right? We look at these UGC platforms, user-generated platforms. We see the cost declines when it comes to creating content. And really where you have had this hold is in kind of that premiere or that long form video, right? Television, all of that is very expensive. Movies, very expensive to create. And then trying to distribute that is extremely hard. And the more that you learn about the industry, the more you realize, oh my God, this can be so much more efficient. And I think that's really what Kino promises. They promise to publishers and indie developers to create data packages. So if you have a digital premiere on the Kino platform, they're able to then surface and insights from who watched that, how long did they watch that, what were their potentially their favorite parts of the movie, all of these different key insights that then these indie developers and filmmakers can take to then actually go and sell and get the, you know, real value out of their film when they bring it to some of these larger platforms. And, you know, I think what will ultimately end up happening is those films and premieres will just stay on Kino because it's going to bring more and more consumers in, and eventually it will be one of these premier platforms that is distributing, you know, content to everyone across the globe. So I think, you know, Kino, it's, you know, where it's, when you look at stories that are this early, there's always a timing element. And I think timing couldn't be more perfect for Kino, because you had the writer's strike, you had the actor's strike. The industry is hungry for something new. They want to be able to get the value that they deserve as filmmakers out of what they're putting into it. And oftentimes when you have Netflix, all of these different services, you know, they're giving you a lump sum of cash up front. And then if that movie goes on to do extremely well, or that TV show like Suits goes on to do extremely well, you're not getting paid anymore for that. Your royalty checks are nothing more than, you know, what they would have been if it had done poorly. So they are offering an opportunity for filmmakers and indie studios to really maximize their value and then delight the consumer, right? Being mobile first, being smart TV first, being available on Roku, Amazon, you know, having a native iOS and Android app. I think that's where the consumer is, and that's what they promise to deliver.
Yeah, like the way I think about it is, you know, there's probably a filmmaker in Des Moines, Iowa, who like, they could shoot a great film, but they would have no chance of getting distribution for that film without going out to Hollywood and trying to like hobnob with a bunch of people.
Right.
And if they did get, you know, picked up for distribution, it would be because of a one-off random amazing meeting, and they would have no leverage in that relationship because they would have no mechanism by which to cross-shop it, really. Like, and so then from the filmmaker's perspective, Kino provides that like mechanism by which to break in, available to everybody. And the cost of creating professional content is collapsing. So there should be more people trying to make movies, and there should be like a better kind of mechanism by which they can win distribution for their movies if they're sufficiently compelling. And then on the audience side, it's like, and you get to, you know, see movies both as they're being made and participate in kind of like engaging with the filmmakers themselves.
Exactly.
And so it's really like, at the very least, like an amazing platform for indie filmmakers and indie film fans. And there's a trajectory for kind of creating a really broad and powerful platform for kind of engaging with content creation and creating distribution channels for professional content.
Yeah, we're very excited to have both of them on, and we really hope that you enjoy it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Enjoy the conversation.
Austin, Daryl, thank you so much for joining us. We're really excited, and we'll just kick it off. We'll get right into it. Really, what inspired you to start Kino? What is Kino? And then really, what is the core mission of the company?
Great question. Thanks for asking, and thanks for having us. This story actually begins at my childhood, so forgive me. I'm going to take us on a little bit of a journey. But I was born in a fundamentalist religious cult that didn't let me go to the movies as a kid. So I wasn't allowed to wear shorts, play sports. We called the TV the television. And as a teenager, my life changed when my big act of rebellion, instead of going out and smoking and drinking like a normal teenager, I snuck out to Blockbuster and rented The Matrix with a friend, which completely melted my mind and changed my worldview. Because if you've seen The Matrix, you know that I was like Neo. I was plugged into this false reality or simulation of reality that was fed to me from a child. So movies literally changed my life. And I left that environment, spent 9 years as a combat medic in the Army, but fell in love with stories and storytelling and film. And so I moved out to LA in 2014 to get my master's degree. And halfway through that program, sold a show to Netflix with Matt Damon and Peter Berg. And my career took off. But I noticed that the film and television industry was extremely inefficient. It was extremely inequitable. And so Austin and I started this company a couple of years ago to try and create more equitability and efficiency in film and TV. Austin, I don't know if you want to talk about why you started this company.
I didn't grow up in a cult, so my story is always less exciting. But I grew up as a kid dreaming to be a big movie star from little town in Ohio. A week before I went to college, I got a call from my dad. He said, "Hey, kid, we've lost everything. You're on your own. Figure it out." And my parents' company got shut down by a lot of regulations. There were a lot of lawyers involved. So I decided in that moment to give up my first love, which was film and TV, and pursue a career in law, because I felt like if I was a lawyer, I could fight against injustice. I would go on to attend Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. I got my master's at the London School of Economics, and then ultimately went to the University of Southern California, Gould School of Law. Fight on. And Daryl hates when I do that. And it was there that I was trained from the best legal minds in entertainment law, particularly focusing on the film and television space. And so when Daryl and I met and sat down for the first time and started chatting about his experience as an executive producer and writer and creative, my experience being trained so deeply in the inner workings of the Hollywood space, we both came to the same conclusion, which was that this system was broken from the inside out, and that the shifting sands below it were causing an impending collapse, that this fortress that is Hollywood, broken from the inside, could not withstand these shifting sands. And that if we founded a company based off of a mission of equitability that could only be achieved through technological efficiency, that could only be founded upon better fan engagement, we could then empower the next generation of creators in the film and TV space. We could provide a better experience for fans, and we could allow for the filmmakers of tomorrow to really have a solid technological base from which to, you know, launch their stories and be the storytellers they want to be, instead of feeling like they had to fight a system. The fact that we call it breaking into Hollywood, I think it's such an antiquated term, right? Like, it is 2024. These are videos on the internet. We should have technology that it's not breaking in. You can focus on creating the art and then go out to your audience.
Okay. So that's all like highfalutin, but tell us what Kino actually does. Like, what? Okay. So yes, I agree. This all sounds good, but what is Kino? Like, how does it achieve that mission? What does it do?
Yeah. So the industry is pretty broken. As a filmmaker, when I was selling shows to Netflix or Disney or whatever, we noticed that it was often in the hands of the distributors to market and distribute the films. And there's a lot of overhead and inefficiencies baked into the way that we work with theatrical and all of that. So what we've decided is, we have an opportunity to deliver and market films more efficiently. There's 4.3 billion people on the internet. How do we connect them? And so what we do is we give fans the ability to get the experience of a Hollywood red carpet premiere from the comfort of your own living room. So you can watch the movie with the cast and crew. We believe that the future of entertainment is interactive. So it's not just on your smart TV, it's on your app. And you can ask questions while you're watching the movie. Afterwards, we do a live Q&A or talk back where your questions are answered, you win fun prizes, and we're creating a true, like, at-home experience that you only get right now if you can afford a $1,000 pass to Cannes or Sundance or one of the larger film festivals.
So the question might be sort of, how does that actually accomplish the mission, right? You know, it is, and I think it's also important, by the way, the best companies in the world were founded on missions, not just products. Those are the ones that become unicorns. And so how do we accomplish that mission by creating an interactive streaming app? Well, the reality is the box office, the physical movie theater, is economically no longer a viable and reliable option to monetize any film, and certainly not a TV show that never went to the theater, right? So you now have 75%, $134 billion worth of content every single year. That's the independent market in particular, that is literally on standstill. We've been at every film festival this year, Cannes, Sundance, South By, you name it. Nothing is getting bought, and nothing has a viable path to get distribution to hit their target audience. And so what do we need? We need a technological solution. Interactivity and creating a digital box office allows to break the noise of the internet and compete with, let's be frank, anything from cat videos to Marvel videos, because we are in the attention economy. And how do we grab attention? We deliver a premium experience. We tap into fan community, and we build an app that is truly at the crux of social media and streaming. We are a social streaming platform.
One of the things that, you know, when I was hearing the keynote story that struck me is there was a perception on Wall Street for a while that Netflix was actually a very data-driven kind of content creator. As in that they, you know, they had cracked the code because they had their user information. And so then therefore they were like their production was working well because they were very data driven. But then actually, as it turned out, no, on the production side or deciding what to produce, they and like in kind of like green lighting things, it didn't seem like they were necessarily data driven. It was actually very personality driven, just like traditional studios. One is that you think that's accurate. And then two, like one of the, it seems like one of the things that you're potentially providing to the Netflixes of the world is actually much richer data on consumer engagement early in the production potential process. Yeah. And so talk about that. Yeah. And am I wrong?
No, you are 100% correct. It's a great question. And you know what I think is actually interesting, and it's interesting because the street is actually starting to price in Netflix where it should be. Netflix is a media company. They sold this sort of idea that they are a true tech platform. But if you think about it, they take $15 or now $25 a month for consumers, and then immediately off their balance sheet, they risk it all on the financing of film and TV. What is that? That is just a studio, right? So you could deliver it digitally. That doesn't make it a true tech platform in the essence that the software has a multiplier effect that persists such soaring valuations as Netflix has had. I'm not here to say that Netflix is a bad company. I think Netflix is an incredible company. They quite literally invented the film and TV streaming apparatus that we understand today. However, to your point, and this is one of the very first questions I asked of one of my professors who's acquisitions counsel at Netflix before we founded the company, how do you price a deal? How do you know how much you are going to spend on a given production, buy a piece of IP, whether that's a film or a show? And the answer was, we have some generic data sets that report from old data from box office, right? Matt Damon's X movie did so many millions of dollars. And they admitted to me that the reality is that that data is not indicative of how it will perform on Netflix, because these are two different beasts. A physical box office, particularly over the past 10 years, is very much a different proposition to the consumer than a digital online experience of streaming. There's entirely different propositions there. And so when you look into how they're making decisions, I think a great example is spending $75 million on Unfrosted starring Jerry Seinfeld. And I have a very good friend that was on the acquisitions team that said, based off of our limited data sets, this is not a good decision. And Netflix still went forward and spent $75 million on a comedy, right? So it's decision-making like that, you're 100% right. It's still based off the old Hollywood model of, if we throw a bunch of money at the stars, it's going to work. And the reality is that's not true, first of all. And second of all, we have to meet the consumer where they're at. And we have to understand that there is actually more opportunity than ever to tap into fan community online if you understand the data behind any given film or show. And then further, you can make better decisions. So to your point, now that we have introduced a digital box office, we give the entire data report to the filmmaker. They can use that deep data sets to then walk into Netflix and say, hey, not only did my film go viral on Kino, and we had, you know, 100,000 or a million or 10 million views, but I'm going to go beyond that and tell you exactly what the age demographics, the location demographics, the interests, the user sentiment, all of that on top of it. And then if we reverse engineer one more time, and stop me at any time if I get too deep here, but if you think about it, the number of data points that Netflix has on any given user, their actual first party data is extremely limited. Ask yourself, how many shows or films do you watch on Netflix in a given month? You probably only watch 5 to 10. And our research shows that on average, the average consumer watches 23 titles a month. And so that might be 5 to 10 on Netflix, who is the leading streaming platform. That's 5 to 10 data points. For me, they think I only like historical dramas because I love The Crown and I've watched that and I've watched World War II movies, right? And so that's what they keep recommending to me, when the reality is they don't truly know me because they have 5 touch points on me. Whereas if you look at social media, every single scroll, you have thousands of data points. Because we have the infinite scroll, we have high engagement, we have all sorts of different opportunities to learn about that user. someone like a TikTok or an Instagram or other social platforms have such a higher quality data on the user. But the problem is they aren't based for film and TV. And so you can't really get true user sentiment on the film and television space because that's not how they're built. So for us, it's about combining those. We have high levels of touch points on user data. We have the features to pierce through the noise of the internet. And then on top of that, we give that data to the filmmaker so they can leverage a better deal at Netflix. Netflix is happy because now they can actually price and effectively reduce that risk of overvaluing certain pieces of IP that actually don't drive subscriptions to the platform.
And if I can just add one other point, it's not just the five shows that I watch on Netflix that are limited, but also my fiance logs into my Netflix account and watches something, and it screws my data up entirely, which is part of the reason that this recommendation algorithm is not actually valid or valuable to me. And then the other thing that I think is really interesting about this whole like kind of egoic driven decision-making process is that it is a studio. They're investing like billions of dollars every year just to try and create content and media. And the decisions that are being made and what drives that is more about the executives than it is about the data of what people want to see, what they want to consume. And that's not just in the US, that's globally. $75 million for a comedy that you know will not travel outside of North America is undeniably a difficult thing to finance at any studio, yet somehow it still happens.
I think you've made the pitch for Kino very clear to the producers and filmmakers. I think you've outlined that extremely well. What is now the pitch when you go to consumers saying, you know, use our streaming app for what reason? You know, what differentiates you from Netflix, all these other services? How do you pitch it? If I'm a user, what is the first thing I see when I log on to Kino?
Yeah, that's a great question. The thing that I think differentiates us from every other platform out there is the ability to interact live with the stars of the film. So if you're a fan of The Hunger Games, we have a movie with Josh Hutcherson that's coming up that I'm really stoked about, and you can actually interact with those individuals. So instead of it being just a boring library, which is what we do on every film and TV, if you think about Netflix, Hulu, Tubi, it's the exact same thing. I'm sitting here, I'm passively watching something. I'm probably scrolling on Instagram or TikTok at the same time. What we have is the ability for you to actually engage with the cast and crew. So you can watch the movie on your smart TV, and then on your phone, you can submit questions. Afterwards, we do a live Q&A. We give away film props. Like, we're doing things that actually engage fans that are very much like what you would experience at Comic-Con or Sundance or one of these larger festivals. It's the opportunity to actually engage with the creators of the content.
Interactivity is definitely first. And that was our first unique feature set that we built out. The second is that we are built where the consumer is today, which is truly a dual screen experience. Almost every single person I ask has said, when I'm sitting and I'm watching my television, I have my phone in my hand. And then I also say, what was it like trying to find a film or a show to watch last Friday night? And they always say, you know what? I sit there, I pull up Netflix, it shows me a couple posters. They're never really spot on, which goes to the point I said previously. I watched a couple trailers. After an hour, I give up. And what am I doing? I'm scrolling TikTok. And so I had that experience. Daryl's had that experience. Our CTO David, our CMO Britt. And we all came together and we said, well, what if we just baked that infinite scroll experience, that For You page, we call it a Discover page, that gives you clips and trailers and teasers and knows what you want to see. And you can scroll, click a button, and boom. Now it's on your television, and you could, you know, click a query that says, hey, I'm in the mood for a quirky, weird 80s, you know, horror comedy, and it's going to pull up Beetlejuice, which, by the way, is about to be back in theaters. And then you see the clip, and you can pull it up on your phone. So on both sides, we are solving the engagement issue, which social media, by and large, has beaten Hollywood thoroughly. My little sister will say, I prefer TikTok stars because they're more like real people than Hollywood stars. So what does that mean? That means that my little sister is choosing to watch influencer videos over films, which beats Hollywood in terms of monetization. So engagement is the number one unique selling point of Kino there. And then the second is discoverability. If we can allow for fans to more easily discover, then it's just a really fun experience. And I know that, hey, I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to watch tonight. I'm going to sit on my couch, pull up Kino, scroll, click, you know, and I'm watching a film. I'm going to share a playlist with Daryl. He's the best at knowing what the top drama is. So I'm going to look at his top 10. You know, I'm going to share with friends. All of those ways that we take cues from the social media space and we combine those with streaming. And in that way, to your point, we empower the filmmaker. But more importantly, we're just creating a really magical experience for fans. And now the question of what am I going to watch tonight is as easy as I'm going to pull up Kino because it's going to give me exactly what I want to see.
Yeah, the way I kind of think about it is, you know, there are people that get to go to movie premieres, right? And those right now, it's like, there's only a few people, right? It's the people involved in the film, the people that are tied into the industry. Well, this is a way that anybody can have the experience of going to a movie premiere where you meet the people, the actors that are involved. They are sharing the product with you. You can ask them questions. And hey, you know, or people that go to film festivals. Well, traveling to France to go to the film festival, that's expensive. There's also tickets. There's a whole thing. Well, this is the way you can actually experience that film festival-like feel of, this is, you know, the cut of the film that exists today. You can interact with the people that made the film and be like, gosh, I really didn't get as much from this character as I wanted. Like, could you, like, you know, shouldn't you emphasize them more? And the cut that actually ends up streaming could actually take your feedback, and that could be important to the final product that appears. And so it's actually a way to be kind of more engaged in actually the process of making, you know, professional content that ultimately, you know, with your platform could scale in a really broad way. And then you have, as the consumer, the thrill of, it's like, you know, I listened to the Strokes before the Strokes were cool, and I'm totally dating myself. Yeah. Right? but it's like, I saw this before anybody else saw it. And then I knew it was like a cool, quirky movie before anybody else knew that movie existed. And by the way, I was talking to the director before he got lifted by, I don't know, Disney to direct whatever the next Star Wars is. Do you know what I mean? And so it's kind of like a way that anybody can have that being a part of Hollywood experience that currently only exists to the people who live in, like, I guess, West LA.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if you think about it, that's not too different from what SoundCloud, Spotify did. You know, a decade ago, music was always well ahead of us in Hollywood, and they democratized the distribution of music, Spotify primarily, but SoundCloud was also an early player. And to your point, you could go and discover that artist early. I think my favorite right now is, you know, some of my friends are like, I was listening to Chapel Roan before Chapel Roan was the it girl of the summer. I was listening to Sabrina Carpenter before Espresso was literally everywhere, right? I mean, those sorts of examples, you now have that opportunity in film, because we're reducing those massive gates. There's a reason there are gates at studios in Hollywood, because that is how this town is built. And the reality is, that's not how the internet works anymore. And we need to empower the next generation. And we need to just meet fans where they're at. Fans want interactivity. They want engagement. And they don't want to spend an hour trying to find a movie to watch at night. I mean, that's kind of ridiculous.
The all-important question here, how does Kino monetize all of this?
Yeah, we don't. I'm just kidding. No. You would not want to hear me say that. So Kino is a freemium model platform. So you can download the mobile app for free. You can download, obviously, on your smart TVs for free. You can scroll all day long on our TikTok scroll and discover all sorts of clips, and the algorithm is start kind of pushing things to you. The minute you want to enter into those exclusive rooms where you're actually now interacting with the stars, you know, the minute you want to sort of be part of that community, then we charge a subscription model of $9.99 per month. Or if you're like, hey, you know what, I just want to try it out for a bit, you could just purchase a ticket to a live digital premiere. We think that both are super important. At the end of the day, it is that combination of social and streaming that allows for us to have a free offering and an exclusive offering. And for you, you might just come to scroll all day long, discover, and you just want to buy a ticket here or there to a cool film. To us, that empowers the filmmaker and captures that instant transaction, right, for revenue streams. But then for others, there's value in having a recurring subscription. It reduces the cost to the consumer. And now they have a really incredible experience with all sorts of VIP perks that non-members don't get. So that's how we monetize.
The other thing that we do that I think everyone else should be doing, and I don't know why they're not, is that we have merchandising opportunities within the app. I was so frustrated when I watched Squid Game and I didn't have the ability to buy the t-shirt or click a button right there in the app and like have the Halloween outfit. You've missed a huge opportunity. On Kino, we do that. So you have the tickets, you have the merch, you have everything there in one contained location. Again, I don't know why people don't do this. And it's really interesting too, because we're one of the only platforms that has first party data about who's actually buying the tickets and who's actually buying the merchandising. Because again, the Netflix, somebody else is actually watching it. Those issues persist. Even I was talking to, I don't think I can say their name, but the head of product for a very large company. And they were expressing their frustration that they sell 30,000 units of merchandise a month for this TV series that's been going on for forever, but they don't actually know who's purchasing it. And so they end up spending very broadly instead of having the first person data which is something that we can help filmmakers get. And usually this data would be very difficult to mine.
Yeah. And by the way, whether or not the transaction is occurring as a one-off for a ticket sale, which is very traditional theatrical, right? Or if we look at the recurring subscription, on both sides to the filmmaker, we beat the market by a factor of 2 to 5x, or even 10x when we get into certain windows of watching, which is important to us. When we sat down and we priced out our model, we said we are going to deliver the highest value to the filmmaker. Because if we deliver the highest value to the filmmaker, we already have baked in audiences of fans that want to see their work. And we'll know that we are the number one platform that's putting filmmakers first. And we're really proud of that. And there are certain ways in which we've actually gone about building our tech stack and our model as a business to ensure that our efficiency drives some of the foundation up so that we can offer the best pricing in the business.
From the filmmaker perspective, it's like, what is the, you know, are you kind of beating the bushes at film festivals being like, hey, you should list on our platform? Is that your mechanism by which you are attracting attention from filmmakers? And then what is, you know, how do they like approach and think about listing on the platform?
Great question. So we have a few ways that we have of acquiring these films. We started off with a single distributor and we were like, hey, we have this thesis. We'd love to run a beta test. And so we took these three films that he was putting in theaters across the United States, 30 days, 250 theaters, and we ran a test with him and we outperformed his box office by a massive factor. And he was like, oh, this is amazing. I want to do 20 picture deals. So we signed a 20 picture deal and that was the kind of start of the conversation. We also have inbound from CAA, UTA, WME, all the big agencies that have sales agents. So while we were at Sundance and Cannes and all of the film festivals, which is where we meet these filmmakers and we talk about Kino and this new opportunity, the reality is that the industry is in such a rough position right now that we had like 206 films that were submitted to us just the last week of June alone, because people are looking for ways to distribute and monetize and cut through the noise of the traditional video on demand market. So the reality is that we have a bunch of different inbounds now, which is great. And it's kind of within the infrastructure of film and TV. Go ahead, Astor.
And also, I mean, to Daryl's credit, he leads our new film and TV partnerships team. It was an expert understanding of the networks and the subatomic networks of the film and TV space. So most people think that you have big X producer and they're the one that runs the show to get their film in theaters and on streaming platforms. That's not how it works. There are a lot of middlemen in Hollywood, which is not always for the best, but it just is how it is, right? And so we have these individuals that are known as sales agents, that are known as distributors. You have your agents, you have your lawyers. And so we had this very targeted approach where we said, to Daryl's point, in beta, we're going to work with individual producers and distributors to prove out our thesis so that we can build upwards to the next level, which is those middlemen. And so one producer, one distributor might have one film or a handful of films. Then we can work with actual large agencies. We can large distribution companies and then large producers like A24 or Neon or names that you might recognize like that. And they have hundreds of films. And then you can work up to the very top level, which is those companies that have thousands of films. And there's actually this interesting space where all of these players work together. And of course, they all talk to one another. And just in the past couple months alone, people have woken up and realized that the sort of drop in distribution, the drop in sales and acquisitions by the streamers is not just a hiccup from the strikes. It is a systemic shift, and that is not going anywhere. When Netflix, when the CEO of Netflix announces that they are no longer acquiring at the level that they used to, and you see over a 50% reduction in the amount of acquisitions occurring, and they're going to go back to licensing older content, and we're going to get into this world. Remember, Netflix originally was a Blockbuster digital equivalent, right? Like they didn't make their own stuff. They would just distribute other people's content. And so now when they announce that that's their strategy, Disney has announced a similar, they're going to increase their licensing and reduce their acquisitions. You have this whole incredible supply of new content that is just waiting in line that no longer has a healthy demand for purchasing. And so what they need is a platform that they can go out and deliver to the world. And so it's been really cool to see the partnerships team now is tapped into every single major player in town. I will hop on calls and people will say, I was hearing about you from X the other day, because what you guys are doing is so necessary. And how did you know this was coming? And I think at the end of the day, it's just because Daryl and I were weirdly geeks and obsessed with this problem. And so we knew that the shifting sands would eventually sort of erode the foundation of the house. And here we are today. But I think that's a good thing, is that we actually have the ability to factor in equitability from the start, instead of as a nice talking point when everybody goes on strike.
What do you think the industry looks like 5 years from now? You mentioned, you know, it's contracting. Yeah. You have streamers playing a huge role, but it's tough out there for the indie creator. So how do you think this industry looks 5 years from now? And what do you think, and you've touched on it a bit here, but, you know, Kino's role in that future looks like?
I mean, I really believe that the future of entertainment is interactive. And I think that we're going to see such a blend of storytelling like we've never seen. So right now, you can put on your Oculus or whatever, and you can watch Kino movies in VR. I think that's really cool. Before long, you're going to be able to wear that VR headset and stand by Zendaya on the red carpet as she's being interviewed. Like, that's the future that we're building to. But also remember that AR, VR, gaming, storytelling, that's all going to blur. And so if I am looking forward to where we're headed, I think we're still going to have the tentpole IP. We're still going to have a lot of the same infrastructure that will be necessary, but tooling is shifting so drastically. The cost of cameras, I think we're going to see such a democratization of storytelling. And then it's going to be more about how do people engage and interact with that audience. And so I think that Kino's role going forward, you know, we're looking at not just how this works for the consumer, but also let's talk about brands, because I am so fucking tired of having my viewing experience interrupted by some tequila company trying to sell me a product that I don't care about at all. And so what I'm looking forward to, and we've started integrating now, we have brands where you can come in and be sponsors of an interactive feature that is very valuable to the end user. It's not a detractive experience, but now it's a positive experience. And so we're revolutionizing not just how it feels for the consumer in the future there, but also for the way that film and TV is even financed. Because way back in the day, soap operas came about, the soaps, because they were selling dish soaps and they were literal ads. And I think we're going to see kind of a re-emergence of the brand integration as well, which is going to be an interesting future.
I mean, one of the stats that I like to look to is 65 to 72% of Gen Z reports wanting to become a creator. And that's a really broad term. And creator economy, I think, is often thought of as just influencers. And that's entirely incorrect. The creator economy includes everyone creating cat videos to $100 million Marvel action movies. And those are all creators. And it's the film and TV creators that often get overlooked for what is sort of the hot creator economy with influencers. But if we think there is that much of Gen Z and Gen Alpha that wants to get into the business of creating media, and that's everything from major feature films down to individual short form content, that means we have a massive reckoning for the indie space. We are not going to see less independent film and TV. And if anything, I think that we're actually seeing that the studio system is starting to question its role and relevancy and how the business of content is created and the kinds of content that they create. Maybe they are best suited for your massive blockbusters like your Oppenheimers and Barbies and Marvels. And maybe your art house pictures are best for individual creators. And all of that, the industry will figure out on the production side. Our job is to ensure that we can live out that mission, like Daryl said, of democratizing. So that if you think about film and TV in 5 years, there is no longer this concept of I need to break in to this cult of Hollywood to even just bring a story to life. That instead, I know that if I have an amazing script and I have a couple of friends that are really incredible at, you know, doing the entire production of a film, and we have some capital and we can put it all together, I have a platform at Kino that I can actually tap into an audience. I'm going to get the data and I can actually make a deal with the top streaming platforms, Netflix, Disney, Hulu, whatever, etc. Very similar to how the creator economy came about in the YouTube era, right? In the Instagram and the TikTok era, we are seeing a revolution that we can fuel with bringing this approach that truly democratizes from a technological perspective. And then for the fans, like Daryl said, just pushing the envelope on having the most incredible interactive experiences, that interactivity allows for the fostering of real community. It breaks that sort of silo of me sitting here on my couch watching my television to now I am part of the action. And Variety just released a really interesting report about how Gen Z and Gen Alpha report that over 53% of their sort of social interactivity is parasocial digital relationships. And that is the crux of actually a lot of their social life is online and is digital. And so by breaking those silos, not only do we create a better fan experience, but that also has the correlated effect of allowing for greater monetization and greater authenticity in an art form that is drastically needing that. Because like Daryl said, Netflix is just a reinvention of a blockbuster shelf. I mean, really, you'll probably never unsee this now. If you look at your screen, you look at Netflix, you look at Disney, they are just rows of posters. And that is exactly what Blockbuster used to be. It is time to change the form and format within which we deliver. and then allow for all of the ancillary benefits to take effect.
Well, I think that's a great message to end it on. Daryl and Austin, thanks so much. And everybody, where can people find Keno, find more, and get on and begin viewing?
You can find us on your Roku, Fire, Apple, Smart TV, phones at Keno.studio. We have apps across all the Smart TV devices. And then on socials at Keno Makes Movies.
Great. Awesome. Thank you so much for joining.
Great conversation. Thank you so much for having us.
It's a pleasure. Great questions. Cheers, everybody.
Great. Thank you. That was FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast. Thanks so much to the Keno team for being on. Thanks, Nick, for joining us. And please like, subscribe, and share the podcast with your friends. And comment. Let us know what you want to hear more of, and I guess what you want to hear less of. Probably me. Probably more of Nick. Okay, so we'll have him on again. All right, thanks so much for joining.
ARC believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARC believes to be reliable. However, ARC does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARC. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARC's current views and assumptions, and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.